Yeah, thanks to you and Kimono My House is where most of my vinyl addiction happened.
You know, Kimono My House in the early 90s was the same way for us. You know, I was living in Texas, and even we knew about Kimono My House. Some friends of mine went to Kimono My House in either 92, probably 92, because I think I went for the first time in 93. They all piled into a car. They drove 8-hour shifts each, so they drove 24 hours straight. It was this mythical story, too, we'd heard about it, which is you go to the building. It's in this warehouse district. You take an elevator to the fourth floor. You walk across the roof to a building on the other side of the roof, and you go in. And at that time in the 90s, the whole walkway was lined in broken Shogun warriors. It's like a pirate's treasure map, you know, like, you go to the warehouse and then you go to here, you find the lady with one arm and then take a left. And, you know, it was crazy town.
If you're watching on YouTube, please like, subscribe, and leave a comment about the episode. And if you're watching on Spotify or listening on a traditional podcast platform, please follow, rate us 5 stars, and leave a review if you would be so kind. Thank you. Welcome to the Wait, I Know You podcast, season 4, episode 38. My name is Nick Rounds, and I will be your host. My next guest is a professional toy maker and the founder and owner of Super 7 and Hybrid Design. Starting as a humble magazine in 2001, Super 7 became a producer of collectible vinyl toys and kaiju figures. Today, Super 7 is juggling many famous brand licenses and working with legendary artists to create unique toys and collectibles. Super 7's motto is, "We grew up with giant monsters, comic books, punk, science fiction, skateboarding, robots, and rebellion. No one made what we wanted, so we made it ourselves." A motto with a through line of DIY attitude of punk rock and the passion for all things nerdy. Brian Flynn, Wait, I Know You. How are you today, sir?
Good. How are you?
Good to see you again after I ran about 30 minutes without actually hitting the record button. And
no, come on. It was only like 5 minutes and everything. We're not concerned about that.
We're already talking about awesome stuff like vinyl and all things Designer Con, this all the fun stuff, and missed it all, but that's okay.
Yeah, it's going to be better the second time. The same thing. It's just like the first time you go down the hill on a sled, it's fun. Second time, it's even better because you know what takes, you know what you're doing a little bit.
You just have to watch out.
We're just greasing the wheels. That's what we're doing here.
Just got to watch out for the tree the second time.
That's true.
Awesome. Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining me today. I can't wait to talk about more about all things vinyl toys, Super 7, and because obviously I'm surrounded by stuff that you've made. The Snake Mountain behind me is from Super 7, and there's plenty of Ultimates behind me as well. So I'm a huge fan.
PSA figures over there. You got some turtles over there.
Actually,
I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate
it. We did the prints.
Yep. Yeah. I got this from the, it's always backwards. This is a Jason Edmondson print. And then I got this from the Super 7 16th store in San Francisco. They just randomly had that for sale and I bought it from them. So huge fan and huge fan of Jason Edmiston for sure. And we'll talk more about that later, but
of course,
yeah. Are you guys ever going to do more PSA figures? We're talking about,
the PSA was pretty much a one-time thing. I mean,
oh, that's a bummer.
It's funny and it's neat and it's cool, but I think we have laughed at that joke. Like, I don't know that it's, you know, same thing. It's like, I'm going to tell the joke again. It's like, well, I don't know if we need to tell the joke again.
Have you laughed at the joke or has the joke come back with a cease and desist? Is that
No. It was everything was above board there.
Okay. Then I would absolutely kill for pork chop sandwiches or a given.
We went away from pork chop sandwiches because the other ones, you know, are fairly straightforward. Pork chop sandwiches is great, but it's also then followed by like a string of curse words, you know, and it's just like, all right, well, which one are we putting out into the world? Let's put out I'm a computer and body massage. Those are a little bit more family friendly rather than, hey, what the fuck you kids doing?
That's true. But I secretly was hoping for like a reaction play set of like the pork chop sandwiches completely like with like a little pork chops cooking range and everything like that. But you know, a man can dream. Oh well.
You know, this is a perfect custom diorama that I would love for someone to make.
It'll happen. I will make it eventually.
Yes.
Probably with some from G.I. Joe reaction figures, no less.
Yeah. Hey, you know, I know where you can get some of those.
Cool. All at super7.com, perhaps. So, Brian, thank you so much for joining me today. It's going to be an absolute pleasure to talk to you. I'm really stoked just because, obviously, I'm such a huge fan of the brand. But I want to talk about the origin story. And I also want to talk about your origin story about, like, how did you become so passionate about toys?
Yeah. And, you know, for everyone that wasn't here, we started this a few minutes ago, so we're gonna rewind question one. He didn't even get out of question one because I talk so much. So that's the good news. So the collecting journey for me is as I mentioned earlier, there's not a distinct singular point. It's more like, you know, little streams that come to a river. So if I'm in a river of collecting now, it started with multiple different streams. First one being, you know, summer after my sophomore year of college, I came home from college for the summer to work, and I decided I wanted to try to find my Star Wars figures again. So I started going to flea markets and stuff. So that was 1991. And then, oh, Star Wars. I remember having 5-inch Shogun Warriors. I had a Mazinga and I had Poseidon. I want to find those. Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. They made the 24-inch ones. I didn't have them. Other people had them. But, oh, now I want to get those. What do I want to get that? So, you know, you start by trying to get the things you remember, and then your eyes start being open to all the stuff that you never saw. In as much in that eye-opening spot as a fan of Godzilla, 1991 is when Bandai started remaking Godzilla vinyls in Japan. So I was fortunate that there was a comic shop in San Antonio, Texas that carried new Godzilla vinyls. And I was like, whoa, what are these? And then those guys were like, oh, but have you seen the old ones? And then once I saw the old ones, my brain just melted out my ears. And I just got sucked into the world of Japanese vinyl, because within a couple of years, it was very easy to complete things like Star Wars. Oh, I want to get all the Star Wars figures. Well, you know, there's 132. Doesn't take that long to get them all when they're $5 each or $1 each, or you buy a whole collection for 10 bucks. Like 1991, they weren't worth anything. So it didn't right. take that long to get everything except Yak Face and Luke with the removable stormtrooper helmet. Those two took a while.
Yeah. Just
everything else, like, you want Imperial Gunners? Nobody wants an Imperial Gunner. Like, it's not a big deal. You can get one. Yeah. Same thing. You want all the Crystar figures? Might take you a month. Yeah. It doesn't take long because no one cares and they're around. So it was real easy to finish up, if you will, American toy collecting. And then I just jumped in headfirst into Japanese toy collecting. And what really struck me on Japanese toy collecting was sort of twofold. First is that the differentiation of how and when the character design comes about. When you talk about something like Star Wars or even classical Universal Monsters, everyone's still basically humanoid, two arms, two legs, a head, might be a hammerhead, you know, might be Snaggletooth. You might be a green wiggly finger guy trying to shoot Han Solo. You might be a creature from the Black Lagoon. All these wonderful monsters that I love. They're great, but they're all still like people monsters.
Still humanoid. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a humanoid monster. When you get over to Japan, it's all bets are off. It's like, this movie is a giant radioactive lizard fighting the concept of pollution. And to win, he's got to rip out its eyeballs. And you're like, who is going to green light that? Oh, no, we already green light that and made the movie. You're like, what? This is mind boggling. And so when you really get into especially the TV show stuff, they went really crazy. So, you know, Kamen Rider is all insects riding motorcycles.
You know, Super Sentai.
Yeah. Baron One, you know, all the villains are, at one point the main villain just starts ripping body parts off of him. And it's like, oh, the eyeball sprouts legs and is a monster. The hand sprouts legs and is a monster. The lips sprout legs and is a monster. You're like, it's giant lip monster. You get into a lot of that stuff. Like, and one of my favorite aesthetic heroes of the time is Inazuman, but it's like the hero of the show is a moth that shoots lightning bolts. Like, we're getting really wacky here. And so the aesthetic of the design of the characters was so intriguing to me, because I don't have any basis of whether or not the show was any good, if the actors were bad, if the plots were terrible. Right. I don't have any baggage. I'm just looking purely at aesthetic. And then when you take that, or people at the time take that, and they reinterpret that into a toy for kids, they make it cuter, funner, simpler. And then how you have to manufacture in vinyl, which is much more limited on what you can and can't do and what can be pulled out. And then they brighten up the color so a kid would buy it. By the time you take that whacked out, you know, origin and retranslate it to vinyl, which in Japan was the cheap toy. So the action figure of the United States is the vinyl toy figure in Japan. There is little regard or concern for accuracy, quality control, or consistency.
Right.
So you end up with these wild looking toys. And I just got sucked deep, deep, deep into that well where the feeling and the emotion you get from the toy becomes paramount over the character. Like, so we know as like somebody selling today, if you were talking about Masters of the Universe, you know that Skeletor is going to outsell everybody else.
Right.
He-Man's going to be a close second, and then it drops off to everybody else. But Skeletor is what's driving that sale, the character. Well, if you've never seen Masters of the Universe, you're like, who's the blue dude with the purple skeleton outfit? Like, that dude's whacked out. Like, you're reacting to it emotionally now. And so when you bring all those forces back together into what we still do today here, I think that when you look at what Super 7 produces, we really try to make sure that the toys are accurate to the characters, but they are just as emotionally significant as they are technically significant, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
So for me, it's always been this thing about understanding and being excited by the distortions and permutations that happen within a character as it gets translated into the manufacturing medium. Like making a vinyl figure that looks 100% realistic to the movie is nowhere near as interesting to me as one that had to be really retweaked and redesigned to fit the medium, because that's really unique. Now it doesn't look like any other thing I've seen before. It's giving me something else. And it's not the most direct analogy, but you know, a lot of times I'd say things like, you know, it's also the appropriateness of the medium. Like, does it make sense to make it like that? Like when you're talking about like Van Gogh's Starry Night, it's a beautiful painting. It's one of the world's most famous paintings. It's also a very shitty coffee mug. Like, it doesn't need to be a coffee mug. It's not appropriate for the medium.
Right.
So trying to make, like in the case of like vinyl, trying to make that a hyper articulated film accurate is not right. But somebody said, it's okay. I'm going to tweak the aesthetics to meet the limitations of the material to create something almost new. And that interpretations of those characters are what really drove me. It's no different than if we're talking about, I got to reverse my hands here, but like
right.
Sokies, like the distortions in the characters that they use to make it work for blow molding, but also functional to hold shampoo is what makes this interesting. It's why, here we go. There we go. It's why that Metal Luna Mutant is so, I can't even do it.
I know it's hard. It's because it's not
Metal Luna Mutant is so cool looking because it doesn't look like any other Metal Luna. It's not accurate in terms of scale and proportion. It's been distorted to the medium, but distorted correctly, if you will, distorted with purpose to a point where you end up with something that's really unique. Now, if you're the person that wants it to be screen accurate, you're not going to be into that. But as somebody that looks at these things almost more emotionally, you're like, you look at something like that and you're like, oh my God, look at how cool that is. That doesn't look like any other Metaluna I've ever seen. It's almost like different artists reinterpreting a character. You know, it's like, that's their painting of Metaluna. And you're like, oh, I love that. It's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's where you get into colorways and different variations and stuff like that. And just at DesignerCon, actually, when I was there, where we chopped it up a little bit, I bought a spray painted pink Godzilla with glitter and everything like that, which was like the most magical thing from like an independent artist. I'm just like, this is a perfect Godzilla. In fact, it was really funny because I remember seeing years ago in Super 7 on Super7.com that you guys had were selling a set of it was M-Pop rainbow Godzillas, and I completely missed out on buying those. And it's one of those things that I regret not buying, just because I'm like, I've always wanted to have a set of rainbow Godzillas, which I didn't think I needed. I know.
Yeah. But that comes with a different perspective on what collecting is and why you're collecting it. And it's not to be dismissive of why anybody collects what they do. We're all weirdos collecting toys. I can't judge what defines somebody else's collection. But to me, that's always been the most interesting, is I know what Godzilla looks like, but like you said, pink, clear pink with glitter, why, what, but wow. If I can take that step back and just look at it in that object version way, where you're like, this is a beautiful thing, and to take Godzilla and twist it with this, that's awesome. Somebody mm-hmm. else will go, there's no historical reason, he's never been pink, what does that mean? But it's like,
because he's awesome,
it speaks to me. And that was one of those things. So when we talked about vintage vinyl, one of those things, because the quality control was literally like, hey, we're out of blue paint, use green. We're out of green paint, use purple. Oh, we're out of orange base vinyl, make it pink. Oh, we're out of pink, make it green. And so it was just like, you look at all these vintage things, and it's not like they were trying to make something limited or different or change or make variants. It was just like, what do we have today? Psh, here you go. Who cares? But that creates then unintentionally this army of variables within character design that becomes so interesting, where you're like, oh, you know, that Godzilla is not supposed to be in unpainted blue, but an unpainted baby blue Godzilla looks awesome.
Yes, yes, it does.
I need unpainted baby blue Godzilla.
So Super 7, the magazine, kind of started out as chasing after a lot of this stuff, right? Of just kind of categorizing a lot of what this stuff was about.
Yeah, I mean, so I started going to Japan in the 90s, mid-90s. I'd been collecting Japanese toys for a number of years, and I finally got to start going over. And so you have sort of twofold. One is, if you're collecting action figures in America at that time, you can buy Tomart's Action Figure News and Toy Review. You can buy Lee's, and then later even Toy Shoot. What was the diamond one? I can't remember. But anyway, but AFN and Tomart's were the big two. They could tell you all the information you needed to know about collecting American action figures. Here's checklists, everything, that value guides, everything that you need. There was nothing about Japanese toys. And ironically, when I would go to Japan, what I realized very quickly early on, one, I was collecting the trash. Like, if you were a serious old school toy collector, you bought tin toys. If you were a new jack toy collector like me, you bought diecast because that was the premium toy, or you bought jumbos. Vinyl was garbage. But the collecting landscape was very different. The way people collected in Japan, for the vast majority of it, was very insular. You don't tell anybody what you have, and you don't tell anybody what's out there, because they might get it. You know, where over here, it's very collaborative. Like, if you found out, if you went to the store today and found that there was a paint variant on the latest Batman figure, somebody would go straight to Instagram or straight to wherever and be like, hey guys, check it out. Look what I found. Go look for one for yourself. In Japan, somebody would go, no, don't tell anybody about this. So when we got to 2001 when the magazine started, what had happened actually was in 2000, we did a book with Chronicle through Jimbo Madison did it with myself and Mark Nagata called So Crazy Japanese Toys, where each one of us had about a third of the toys in the book. And then they wanted a sequel to the book and none of us were willing to do a sequel. And I said, why don't we do basically a punk rock fanzine? There's magazines out there that tell you about action figures, but there's no magazine out there that can tell you about Japanese toys. So I started doing articles about, hey, here's all the stuff you need to know. Like, you want to know about a vintage Godzilla from 1966 to 1974 from Marison and Bullmark? Here's a guide to the main sculpt and all the variations and what's been done. Not even in Japan would they put those articles out. So we sort of did the reverse, where Japan would be like, here's a book about everything you ever wanted to know about Nike sneakers or old denim or Hawaiian shirts, down to like the stitches. We did the exact same thing for their toys because they weren't doing it. And we never really intended for the magazine to be anything because we didn't think anybody would really care other than a very small group of people. And that's why it was approached from the very beginning as basically a fanzine project. And then to our surprise, it was popular. People did like it. And there were far more people that were interested in this subject than had originally, than maybe you would have known, but simply because they'd never been able to find a place to find out about it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So it was funny because after the first issue of the magazine, I went back to Japan and I got scolded by a very longtime senior collector who had told me about a tail variant on a Godzilla. And he was like, I didn't tell you that so you could tell anybody else. And I was like, okay. But, you know, my thing is like, I want to share this excitement. I want to share all this. Let's go. Let's build. Let's go crazy with this. Like, I'm not as worried about it. It's the same thing like an issue, either two or three, I can't remember now. We did an article on the IKB Hedras, which were these bootleg Hedras. There's technically nine of them. There's three different sculpts and there's three paint variants of each sculpt. I had four of them. I knew the moment that we did the article on them, I'd never get all nine. I still to this day only have five, you know, because the moment we told everybody what they were and where they could find them, you know, 3 months later, 90 days, 3 months later, they were gone and you couldn't find them and the prices went through the roof. And that was it. But it was like, but that's okay. I have five out of the nine. Like,
yeah,
I'm okay. Like, it'd be nice to have all nine, but I'm not going to kill myself to get all nine.
Yeah. I have a couple one of one Sifui pieces that like I have that I'm super proud of, but yeah, it's okay. Like other people can have more other stuff. That's like the similar colorway or whatever. So
yeah. These weren't necessarily one of ones. They were very rare and most people didn't know what they were. So when they would show up, people would just be like, oh, that's trash. That's 10 bucks.
Mm.
And we'd be like, actually, that's not trash. And then they went from being 10 bucks to being 500 bucks in the space of like 2 years, you know?
Yeah. And then people
knew what they were and they could quantify them and figure it out.
Right. And then that the original book that kind of kicked off before Super 7, like a third of the collection also came from Kimono My House, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, it was one third myself, one third Mark Nagata, and one third Kimono My House.
Yeah, between Kimono My House and you guys of Super 7 on Haight Street, when the original, well, not the original location, the second location, right?
Technically the third, because there were two different locations on Post Street, but they were next door to each other, but that's fine.
Okay, a location.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. Actually, yeah, yeah. Thanks to you and Kimono My House is where most of my vinyl addiction happened. Where I got my first Mummy Boy and Burger Buns, and also Foster. Foster's another one that I was a huge fan of. When you're talking about like inanimate objects are cute, made for kids, but then repackaged to be something somewhat disturbing because where Foster is a ice cream sandwich that has a piece of his head bitten out of it and he's like biting his own head because he's hungry, which I think is just so awesome. But yeah, I love that kind of stuff. And going back to the aesthetics of stuff, like that's really where I fell in love with Sophobia Figures is just like get in love with the aesthetics of like the colors and like this one has sparkle, this one's purple, this one's, you know, every color of the rainbow and every, you know, different version of it. I just I love that. Just walking into Super 7 for the very first time, that I was kind of transported to this magical world that you knew all about, but I was just discovering for the very first time, but just walking in the store. So yeah, very, very, very thankful that you went deep down that rabbit hole.
Well, to that point, you know, Kimono My House in the early 90s was the same way for us. You know, I was living in Texas, and even we knew about Kimono My House in the 90s and late 80s. Like, there were only two places really in the country that you could get Japanese toys: Pony Toy Go Round in LA and Kimono My House in San Francisco. And I remember some friends of mine went to Kimono My House in either 92, probably 92, because I think I went for the first time in 93. They all, you know, this is in college, right? They all piled into a car, 24-hour drive to get to Emeryville / Berkeley. They drove 8-hour shifts each. So they drove 24 hours straight. And we all gave them money ahead of time. I remember giving them like $45, which in college terms is probably $10,000.
That's a lot of Taco Bells.
That's a lot. I remember giving them $45 and we just like, just whatever, man, just buy me cool shit. And I remember they went to Emeryville to Kimono My House knowing that it was in the warehouse district, and like literally going there, getting to a phone, looking it up in a phone booth, finding an address, because it was this mythical story too. We'd heard about it, which is you go to the building. It's in this warehouse district. You take an elevator to the fourth floor. You walk across the roof to a building on the other side of the roof and you go in. And at that time in the 90s, the whole walkway was lined in broken Shogun Warriors. Since got stolen or whatever. But it was this like, Like, it's like a pirate's treasure map, you know? Like, you go to the warehouse and then you go to here. You find the lady with one arm and then take a left. And, you know, it was crazy town. But it was still like, it was magical. Like, you went in there and you're like, all of these things that I never knew existed are here. So when you, you talk to a lot of the people that have been collecting, especially deep Japanese vinyl in the greater area around here, all of us started by going to Kimono My House. And like, when we opened our store, it was like, what's my version of what Kimono My House was? Like, what do I want that to be? Kimono My House, Yuki, that used to run it. I mean, that was our church. So, you know, I don't want to spend too much time on that, but at the same time, I want to be very, they're still open till this day. But like, Kimono My House was the place that helped incubate all the people that are involved at vinyl at the high end these days. Like, Dennis Hammond, who was, you would have seen at DesignerCon, who runs his own factory in Japan, does vinyl for a lot of people, worked at Kimono My House originally.
Oh, wow.
In the 90s. Like, that's when I met Dennis. You know, these people are still around. So it was a, you know, for lack of a better description for many people, it's the Gilman Street for Japanese toy collectors.
There's always a band. There's always a person. There's always somebody you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, how did you guys transition from just becoming a magazine to actually selling Sophobia and Kaiju figures? How did that happen?
So, in the very first issue of the magazine, we had coupons that you could cut out for mail away vinyl. So, at that time in Japan, if you bought Figure King or Hyper Hobby as a way to push sales of the magazine, they'd have a coupon in the middle of the magazine that you could cut out a coupon and send in like $75, and you could get an exclusive recolor of a vinyl figure that was limited to just the magazine. So we wanted to recreate that experience in the magazine domestically. I'm like, that's such a cool thing, because, you know, I'm having to go through people I know in Japan that are like billing me like, okay, it cost me $5 to buy the magazine and the, you know, and I'm paying them to do the process for me to get these things. So we went over to Japan and we arranged, two exclusives for the magazine, a 54 Godzilla bear model in clear gray and an M1 Gorgo. And, that was the beginning of it, because even with that clear gray Godzilla, they were like, all right, well, what do you want to make your colors? And we're like, oh, it's a clear gray Godzilla, because when Godzilla is underwater at the end, when he gets killed by the oxygen destroyer, you know, it's translucent, you know, whatever. That's what the idea was. If you look at the Gorgo, it's flesh vinyl with blue paint all over it, like the flesh Godzilla was. So when we started making recolors in subsequent issues, we would get wackier and wackier with our recolors into the world, much like you're saying, of like, oh, one of the earlier ones was, it's Hedorah the Smog Monster, but I want it in clear orange with yellow and red highlights. And they're like, first off, nobody wants Hedorah. And two, where that colorway didn't ever happen. Nothing ever is like that. And we're like, no, but it's rad. And we're approaching it from an aesthetic point of view. This is a beautiful toy now with this paint job. And so what happened very quickly was our perspective on repainting toys became very popular because it didn't look like anybody else's toys. It wasn't a reference to a vintage paint job. It wasn't this. It wasn't serious. It was outlandish and wild, if you will, to a degree. So that led to us making more repaints. Those repaints sell better sometimes than the original figures. So then it's like, well, what else would you like to make? So then we started saying, well, if you make a toy in this size or in this scale of this character, we'll buy that as an exclusive. And then more or less sort of like line planning with other companies what to make, that then involved into creating some of our own characters with other companies, which would be like the Ghost Fighter and everything. And then eventually making our own characters like Mummy Boy in Japan for ourselves. So it was kind of an organic growing up process, if you will. But that's kind of how we got into it, which was just, you know, say, man, what do I want to have? This is what I want. Well, Hedorah at that time, I remember when we made the first Hedorah, we pushed a manufacturer. We're like, look, if you make a Hedorah, we'll buy this many. He's like, I'm not going to make Hedorah. No one in Japan cares about Hedorah. We're like, no, we'll buy this many. Trust us. And he's like, okay, I'll make a Hedorah. And then he made Hedorah, and all of a sudden everybody's like, no, we love Hedorah. We just never have had a chance to buy it. Because Hedorah is, especially in the Japanese kaiju world, he's the most original and unique aesthetically, and it can change forms so drastically. The interpretations you can take with Hedorah are much more varied than you could ever do with even a Godzilla or anything. So
right.
Now you're like, oh yeah, everybody makes Hedorah. But in the early 2000s, there was like three Hedorah toys available. That was it. And so it then became known, if you make Hedorah, Super 7 will buy a shitload of them. All of a sudden, people started making more and more Hedorahs, and we bought more and more Hedorahs.
I love it. So going from there, the company really transformed in 2013 when you guys introduced the Aliens Reaction line for the very first time. For context, Reaction is a 3 3/4 line with 5 points of articulation, reminiscent of Kenner Star Wars figures. Yes. Can you talk about how Reaction has grown and how the fans of Reaction, why they love it so much specifically?
Yeah, I mean, really, when you talk about Reaction, I mean, that 2013, that is the beginning of the switch from Super 7 that we've been discussing this whole time, that still exists here. It's just small, to the Super 7 that most people know of as today. Because when we are talking about a Japanese vinyl repaint, you know, there's only so many people that have a frame of reference, or when they see it for the first time, it speaks to them in a deeper level. It's not as easily translatable to as many people, which is fine. It's not a condemnation. It just is. It's a very niche product in some ways. when you start talking about something like reaction figures, every kid of a certain age had 3¾, 5 POA figures growing up. They know exactly what that is. So when you make a twist or a tweak on it, they're there with you immediately. So what happened was, just prior to that, I believe in 2010, we got the opportunity to make the Super Shogun Stormtrooper, which was, you know, it's like, okay, I had Star Wars figures as a kid, and I had my friends had Shogun Warriors. What if I had a Shogun Warrior that was a Stormtrooper? Oh my God, there's Optimus. Although we've got to give you the clips to fix your door. If your door is broken, Nick, and that's because you don't have the right clips. I have clips that fix your door.
Oh, well, that's good to know.
Yes. So it shipped with the wrong thing in there, but that gets fixed. But anyways, that's what I wanted. So that was the first time we made a product that, if you will, more domestic consumers could easily understand. And after the success of the Stormtrooper, we're like, oh, that was, you know, it was basically a 2.5-3 year project for us. We were like, that's really cool. We should get started on Boba Fett. But this is going to take us 2.5 or 3 years. And we started kind of going, all right, well, is there anything else? And going back to Tomarts, I believe, or maybe it was AFN. I always say Tomarts, I think. They had done that cover story on the unreleased Alien figures. And so as a toy collector, not just a Japanese toy collector, as a toy collector, I was like, you know, the one thing I would kill for are those Alien prototypes. And then we were just like, cool. Could we make those? Could we redo that? Could we do that? Maybe we could do that. I don't know. Should we try?
So we made it ourselves.
So we went out, we tracked down a bunch of the prototypes. We were able to buy a couple of them. One of them we did side-by-side sculpting. One doesn't exist, and we had to work off photographs. But we remade the lost 1979 Alien action figures. But I want to be very clear. Like, when we went to San Diego with it, you know, we're going to bring it out at San Diego. Woohoo, party! Our version of that is, we're going to go down there. I hope we can sell 500. Because it's low articulation, low likeness, low paint apps, higher price point. Like, who's really going to want these and know about Alien reaction figures other than the nerdiest of the nerdy diehard toy guys? And instead, what we realized is that when we showed up with that, that everybody our age went like, oh, that's the toy I grew up on. That's what I've been waiting for. And that really was that then the floodgate of like, now I've made something as a toy company 12, 13 years in that then speaks to a much larger American audience than where we've been. Doesn't mean that I wasn't trying to, but I wasn't speaking in a language that most people understood. So when I start talking about, you know, I'm sure there's people that have suffered through this already and they're going, talking about Hetera and Bullmark and Marison, like, I don't have a frame of reference to anything you're talking about. But when you show me a Kenner 3¾ figure that looks like a Star Wars figure, all of a sudden I know exactly what you're talking about. And now you make me feel like a kid again. And it's that emotional resonance, that is the emotional attachment to it. It's not an analytical attachment. It's an emotional attachment. And I think that's the thing still to this day. We really try to make sure everything that we make has that emotional quality first and foremost. You know, I know there's people out there that have differences of opinions, but it's the same thing like sometimes where they're like, why don't you have double jointed versus single jointed versus this versus that? And it's like, because the emotional side of how this looks and feels so much better with single joints than double joints. I understand that that may not be the aesthetic choice that you would make or the functional choice that you would make, but that is the choice that we have made to make the figure feel the way we want it to feel.
Right.
Yeah. I took that on a sidetrack.
No, it's good. And it's been 10 years of reaction too, which I think is an incredible accomplishment. So congratulations for that.
Yeah. I mean, I would have never guessed in a million years, but at the same time, once I sort of saw that happening, you were like, oh, there's an opportunity here. And this is just as much fun as making a vinyl toy. I'm just now getting to do it on the American side. And I think we were lucky at the time where manufacturing in China was becoming easier, so that you got to a point where a smaller company could exist that 10 years prior probably could not have gotten away with it. Like you could exist outside of having to sell at Target and Walmart and Toys R Us. And you could find manufacturers that could deliver you the quality that you wanted, but at much, much lower quantities. So luckily we were there, but I would say to a degree, we also helped build some of that interest and build some of that market that didn't exist there too.
And because of Reaction, it's kind of like been a real, I mean, in addition to the Super Shogun stuff where you got the Star Wars license for the first time, which is really awesome. Reaction, you've done a ton of licenses and done all kinds of amazing collaborations. Is there a license that you still kind of pinch yourself over that you got to work with?
You know, there's the things that I don't make things that we're not excited about. So let's be, and as I realize I'm in front of like work shelves here, but as anybody who knows, there's like another room over here that's full of like my shelves. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I will make and collect as much stuff as there's room for, plus twice as much more. So I don't want it to be like, which of your child do you like more? But I think some of the things that's been super fun is, you know, especially Worst and Weirdest, where we're getting to make some of our own characters and put those ideas out in the world and see people, same thing, come to them and just be like, I don't know who this guy is, but he's awesome looking. I love it. Like that's been super fun. That's really rewarding and interesting. At the same time, I get just as excited about things like the upcoming O-ring line. I realize it's not Reaction, but the O-ring line that we're doing with G.I. Joe. Like I'm going to get to extend the historical, or I was going to say the historical history. Clearly that's
the historical legacy. I'm going
to be able to put in characters that follow on in the exact vernacular of the vintage line. For that to happen, that for me to be the guy that gets to do that, that's crazy. There's a million people out there that would love to do that. And they've all got their ideas, but I get to be that guy. So there's always the thing I'm working on right now that I'm super excited about. And that's not at the cost or detriment to the thing I already did, but it's like, I'm excited about all of it, quite honestly.
Yeah.
And some of these things though, you definitely have to take a step back. And like you said, when you say pinch yourself, it's like, holy moly, we're going to make O-ring G.I. Joe. Like, that's a really big deal.
Yeah. And talking about like joints and stuff like that, are you planning on having them like have joints and like bends of the elbows and stuff like they used to like in the 80s?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's got to be just like the old. I'm making line extension. It's exactly like the old ones. You're going to have the rivets in the shoulders, the screw in the back, swivels. Like it's got to be like that because that's what those figures are.
Well, you're officially going to take over more of my toy room thanks to that. So,
yeah. I don't have a problem with that, Nick.
Because I have plenty of Reaction on the front of my desk. Like, I have, like, Run the
Jewels. Oh, yeah, Killer Mike.
I have plenty of, like, Reaction stuff in front of me. I think and you're talking about the Worst and the Weirdest, and those are two, for context, those are in-house brands of Super 7. So here's Blued from the Weirdest. But I'm a huge fan of both the Worst and the Weirdest for sure, just because I love that they're brand new, unique characters that are just all part of a rogues gallery. Yeah. That's brand new. And also also because you've commissioned Ed Repka to do a lot of the art. Can you talk about who Ed Repka is and why he's so awesome?
Ed Repka is an amazing illustrator and painter. Most people know him from his metal covers in the 80s and into the 90s. And when we were starting the first Universal Monsters Reaction figures, I was like, the card backs have to look like old Famous Monsters of Filmland magazines. Obviously, Basil Gogos no longer with us. So we were like, who could paint like that? Who could paint like that? Who could paint like that? And then we went to Repka and we're like, hey, could you do some Universal Monster stuff that looks like Go-Go's? And of course he's like, I love Go-Go's. Who doesn't love Go-Go's? What do you need? And so he knocked out those paintings. And then we're just like, all right, we were just like, okay, Repka, we need you to paint everything, not everything, but just about everything. So he painted the worst for us and everything else like that. And I, you know, between him and, as you mentioned earlier, Jason Edmiston, like there are, it's like stop one and two is like Ed and Jason. All right. And if they're too busy, then we'll start talking to other people. But like, yeah, if I can get Ed or Jason to do it, I know it's going to come out better than I could have imagined.
Yeah. This, it's always flipped around, but this behind me is from Jason Edmiston. Huge, huge fan of his work. And he's been tackling all the G.I. Joe paintings for you that are kind of indicative of, I forget the original, the artist who was kind of really famous for like the classic G.I. Joe explosion. And like,
there's a couple, but yeah. Yeah. Well, and same thing, like when we approached Jason, we're like, hey, you know, I don't know if you've got the time, but we'd really like you to do G.I. Joe for us. He was like, that's why I started painting. The G.I. Joe card backs is what made me want to start painting. So he's like, I'm in for everything. Just don't even consider that you're going to give it to anybody else. It's mine. I was like, okay.
Hector Garrido, that's who I was thinking of.
Yeah.
Yeah. His stuff is super awesome. And then also you got to collaborate with Chris Sherry as well, working on the Descendants line as well, which I thought was really awesome.
And Chris, the same thing. I've known Chris for 25, 30 years. You know, I've known him forever. He's a wonderful human. But, you know, same thing. Like, we've talked forever. Like, when are we going to get to do something together? When are we going to get to do something together? And it finally came together, you know, all these years later in the Descendants figures. But, I mean, we carried one of Chris's shirts at the store in the early 2000s. I remember at one point Chris came to the city because he had gotten custom cowboy boots made that had the big Great Bazinga V's on the front with like Mazingas down the side and stuff. Like that. And he was like, Chris is just next level awesome. And he's always on to some next stuff that you don't even know yet. You don't even know yet, but Chris is already there. He's moved in, he's bought a place and invited his friends. It's like, and he's just the nicest guy in the world. For those who don't know what we're talking about, most of the Descendants art that you've seen throughout your life has been drawn by Chris. It was originally drawn. There's a guy that drew the original Milo, and then some of the other stuff was drawn by, I'm blanking on his name, but then Chris sort of took it over. But Chris is the go-to illustrator for sort of everybody in the old punk rock scene from the 90s up. Like, he was doing everything. And he's a diehard toy collector, nerd, crazy man, and he's wonderful. And he always has the most outlandish facial hair.
He definitely does have a hell of a handlebar usually.
Yeah, it's just like, this week it's going to do this, and this week it's going to do this, and then it's going to do this, and then, you know.
That's awesome. So touching on music stuff, one of the things I really love about Super 7 just as a brand is that you guys have a really huge affinity for both hip-hop and metal icons, like cult heroes, really. Mm-hmm. Obviously, with me showing Run the Jewels just now. Can you talk about why Super 7 as a collective are just such huge nerds about hip-hop and metal?
I think, you know, for me, you know, music has always been such a big part of this. We talk about a little, you know, I mentioned a little bit, but, you know, my backstory is my parents were in the military. We moved around a lot, but mostly we moved around within Texas. We did some other stops, but growing up, it was, yes, I'm into all these, you know, I'm into comic books, I'm into all this other stuff, but it was really skateboarding and punk rock or at least for me, that really defined who I am. And in the 80s, those were one and the same. Like in 1984, when I was skating in punk rock, that was one group of people. There were not two groups of people and not even subgroups within those. It was like, there's only five of us, so we're all hanging out together. You know, it's like the punk rockers, the skateboarders, the goth kids. That's all of us. And there's only five of us. And you're kind of into all of it. It's all one and the same. But you also had to work really, really hard to get that stuff, and it wasn't accessible, and it was very outside the mainstream. So, you know, as we grow up, you know, we all sit here and talk about nostalgia all this time, like, oh, I love Star Wars. I loved Crystar. I loved Clash of the Titans. Well, I also loved, you know, Minor Threat or Public Enemy or that. It's like, what are those, the soundtrack to your life? And that's like, why don't we make that stuff too? And it started off, ironically enough, with Gorilla Biscuits, which was the first punk band that I was really sort of super tied to because I felt like they were my peers rather than older. That was the first group of like my peers that became big. And I met them. I didn't meet them till 1988, but I met them in 1988. Long story short, the cover of their 7-inch is this gorilla in a champion hoodie, you know? And I was like, he's a mascot. He's a toy, not unlike our mummy boy. He's their mascot. Like, what if we made a toy of the gorilla from Gorilla Biscuits? And then I talked to Siv about it, and Siv's an actual toy collector. He collected 12-inch G.I. Joes. For the record nerds here, they'll be like, yes, there were Revolution trade, you know, thing inserts in the original records. And it's like, yes. So he was like, yeah, let's do it. We didn't really think about more of it than that. But once we did it, we're like, oh, there's this whole world that we can be doing. And that's when we started jumping into like, okay, let's make the Eliminator from Agnostic Front, and let's make Social Distortion, and let's make the Descendants, but let's also make, you know, Eric B. and Rakim, and let's also make, you know, Run the Jewels. We made Uncle 77 with Uncle James Lavelle. It's like, of course, it's a space alien. Let's make it. These things are should be toys. And I don't know that there was a much bigger plan other than just like, oh my God, I love this stuff too. All of a sudden I realized my peanut butter and my chocolate taste really good together. So I'm going to make peanut butter and chocolate.
Yeah. I love all the metal figures. Huge fan of Lemmy. I love that you guys are involved with Cliff Burton specifically. Shout out to the East Bay. Yeah, I'm really surprised you guys haven't like made like Slipknot figures, just because like, I know that Corey Taylor is actually a huge fan of Reaction.
I would love to make Slipknot figure. The problem that we've run into, at least, and maybe I'm wrong, so if Corey, if you're listening, tell me, the word that got back to us is you can't make Slipknot unless you make every member of the band.
Mm.
I don't, because of the sheer volume of cost to get into tooling, I don't think I can sell 7 to 9 figures at enough volume. If it's 1 or 2 figures, I could do it in a heartbeat. But I don't think I can do everybody. And yeah. I love that they are out there with parity for the whole band and not to prioritize anybody above others. But that's the reason we haven't made Slipknot, is simply that the word that came back to us was like, you have to make, I think it was at that time, 7. I know it fluctuates at times.
Yeah.
It was like, unfortunately, there's definitely a few of these that it would sabotage the rest of the other figures if we made them. Does that make any sense? Sounds terrible to say, but it's just like, they're not going to sell the same way.
Yeah. I would expect like an STC, like release of like a full band, maybe like a full lineup, and like one of their iconic looks. But then after that, yeah, selling individually, I would definitely want individual ones, like having my own individual Joy Jords and on card and everything else would make a lot of sense. But yeah.
Hopefully, if Corey is, if somebody else is listening to this that knows Corey that gets it over there, like if we can work something out, I'd love to do it. But at least what I've been told is I can't.
So I have one more final question for you, and it is it's a fun question.
All right.
Very, very serious though. The worst is a rogues gallery of villains, and that's kind of indicative of like Batman's rogues gallery or like Spider-Man's rogues gallery. Of all the villains of the worst, who is the most likely to be a great villain for Batman?
Well, see, where we started out with the worst was, and the initial impetus was, bad guys always have the best costumes. They always look the coolest. The good guys never look as cool. Like, since we use masters as that same thing, who looks cooler, He-Man or Skeletor? It's not going to be a question. We all know who wins, right? Darth Vader looks a hell of a lot cooler than Luke Skywalker. His costume is better. It's not saying I discount Luke because I love Luke. That's who I thought I was going to be when I was a little kid. I was going to grow up to be Luke Skywalker. But, you know, the bad guys always have the best outfits. We were talking about that as a toy line. We're like, what if we made a line that was just nothing but bad guys? And then we're like, they're just the worst. And we're like, yeah, that's where it started. Where it evolved to is that they're actually the worst of the worst. They're actually terrible. They're completely inept at their job. Like, they may have great costumes, but they're terrible villains. So as far as which worst would be that give Batman the most run for his money, quite honestly, the one that we've always come back through some of the internal storyline and dialoguing that we have is sort of, you have a couple where it's like Black Falcon is, he's just old. That's his issue. But it's like, he was a badass in his day. He's just old, you know? And I mean, he's a living skeleton at this point. Right. But like, he could be pretty good. Like, and then Cortex Commander, probably. Those two would really give him a run for his money. But like Werewolf Biker, probably not.
Those are good ones. Yeah, I have some of my my ultimates here.
Yeah. You're like, all right, Black Falcon could, yeah. But at the same time, you're like, okay, if he's a living skeleton at this point, like, does he just like get hit and fall to pieces?
Yeah, I think my favorite one of all time is Batula. I just love that I have, thanks to you, I have a double middle finger.
like Batula is the same one where it's like, he's trying so hard to be cool. Like, he's like, no, vampires are cool, dude. And it's like, not that kind of vampire. Like,
not one with like the blue blockers going on and everything.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
You know, it's the same thing. It's like, he got... It's like, you know, Twins, where you had Danny DeVito, and he's the Danny DeVito of the Vampire Club here.
I love it. I will continue to collect the worst. I'm a huge fan of the line. I have all the ultimates so far. And
That's great. Like, you know, the Robot Reaper with like the people to delete disc that slides into the back of his head. You know,
yeah.
they're super fun. That's the whole thing. It's like, this can be fun. It doesn't always have to be, well, technically he's got 72 scales on his back and you only put 71 scales on his back. It's like, we're still trying to make these toys and have fun with them and build up stories in our own brain about them. And just, it should put a smile on your face when you see it. That's the goal. Where you're like, oh, I love it. This is hilarious. This
is fun. And you're getting me for the same reason that you got me with Mummy Boy back in the day. It just, aesthetically, I'm just a huge fan of what it is. And the second I see it, it just makes me laugh and smile. So yeah, I love this stuff. And I love that you guys continue to just commit to the brand identity of just always making stuff that you guys think should exist. And I'm super thankful for it. So Brian, thank you so much. No, I appreciate it. Brian, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Before we take off, is there anything that you'd like to plug? Cool things happen in your life? Social media sites?
I'll give you all, we'll do all the social media handles here. But, you know, I'm not plugging anything specific, but if you want to check out what we're doing, if you've made it this far, I'm fairly certain you know all this information. But the website is super7.com. That's SUPER, the number 7.com. Instagram is @super7 or @BrianFlynn if you want to see what I'm up to. And I post about once a month, so it's not a heavy lift. You'd be like, oh, he actually posted something. Oh, okay. I just don't get there as much as I'd like to. And, you know, it's the same Facebook, I think, is super7. And we're just out here having fun. And hopefully, come on, stop by, join us, hang out, talk about toys. That's all we're doing.
Good times. Awesome. Brian, thank you again so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah. Well, it was great. I'll talk about toys anytime anybody wants to talk about toys.
Well, I might have to have you back on then.
All right.
Everybody
and then,
else?
And then separately, even though we're wrapping this up,
yep.
Shoot me an email so I can send you the clips for your Optimus.
For my Shogun? Yeah, I will. Yeah, it. Yeah, because the first batch
that got out the door had the wrong clips on the doors, and so they pop open and they don't stay in place. We have all the extra clips. A lot of them, so the very first ones don't, and like that's so disappointing. It's like, come on, it's 90% here, and you mess up the doors. Like no. Here's the clips. All of a sudden, the doors will be perfect as they're supposed to.
Well, I'm really glad that I interviewed you and I pulled out my Optimus, because now I can have a complete
Have it complete and correct with the correct clips on the doors. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. I appreciate your attention to detail and always having your customer service hat on at all times. So
look, like I said, it's an emotional purchase. You didn't buy that for technical reasons. You bought that for emotional reasons, and I don't want it to let you down.
I bought it because I always wanted the, I remember seeing the Super Shogun Stormtrooper for the very first time and being like, not having enough money to buy it and being like, that's awesome. I've always really wanted one of those. So when you came out with the Optimus one, I was like, all right, I gotta spring for that. I would definitely want a Shogun figure.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, I'm sorry that you got one where the doors weren't correct.
It's all good. We're about to fix it shortly. So
exactly. So what we're here to do today, we're going to fix all the problems.
Right the wrongs, save the day, destroy the swamp monsters and the evil pollution monsters. And
exactly. Rip there. The eyeballs out of Hedera right now.
All right, Brian, thank you so much for your time. Right, everybody else, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. And we'll catch you next time.